Aussies love the bush, but sometimes the bloody bush doesn't love us back. I'm John Harper, just a simple joker talking about why mental health is everybody's business and what to do if you think a mate is struggling.
This podcast is a Room 3 production and brought to you by our mates at the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries and their Farm Business Resilience Program team. You'll be hearing the lived experiences of everyday folk in rural and remote Australia. The language can be strong at times, and references of suicide may upset some people. So consider who's within earshot when listening. Any advice in this podcast is of a general nature, and we recommend seeking professional health advice from your GP or medical professional. If you're struggling with your mental health, please visit the show notes or matehelpingmate.org.au for links to trusted service providers across the country. If you're struggling with your mental health now and need to talk, call Lifeline anytime on 13 11 14.
Because you used to just go eat lunch, go sit out in the car and eat, or go sit out on the step and eat, not talk at lunchtime. Like, can't remember when that was a bit of a crossover, but that's when things were getting really, really bad. He'd work. He'd always, you know, smile and chat, but then as soon as, you know, work was just, you know, have a smoke or whatever, he'd just retract from everyone else. People used to go, "What's wrong with Joe?" I said, "It's just Joe. Like, I don't know."
20 years ago, you go down the street to do your banking, but now you just sit there at the kitchen table and you do it all on your phone and you think, "This is awesome. I can get it all done." But you're not talking to anyone as you're doing it.
Isolated himself from his friends, I guess, and as 10-year-olds, you can't expect too much from his mates to really understand what he was going through, so he just didn't want to be involved in their activities. So, you know, to see him sitting on his own at lunchtime was hard for the teachers, it was hard for my wife when she was in there at canteen and things. And I guess the thing that probably struck me the most, he's coming out the other end of it now, is how fickle the human mind is and how easily it can be triggered into a downward spiral.
I've been on antidepressants since I was 15. Realistically, they have saved my life multiple times. And the more that we can get more people, particularly rurally, to stand up and tell those stories, the more it makes it easier for the next person to do the same thing.
G'day, podcasters. John Harper, Mate Helping Mate, here to give you ears another flogging. This episode is recorded with young pups, the younger generation. As an older generation, we think that people should just do as we say. This is the young pup's opportunity to tell us, how do they think? How do they deal with mental well-being and mental health issues today? This is recorded in a small village of Springdale that's in Tamora Shire, and the Shire is about 6,500 people, and it is focused on dryland agriculture, on cropping, wheat, canola, barley, and on livestock enterprises such as sheep, cattle, fat lambs. So, run-of-the-mill, to a certain extent, ag sector, except us people who live here believe this is God's own country. In this episode of Young Pups, I am stoked to introduce to you some young guns. I believe are young guns, but in fact, they are mirror images of young farmers all over Australia. And our speakers today are Ben Kotzer, Michael Sinclair, and the lovely Emma Robinson. Ben talks candidly at the start about his older brother Joe's attempt of suicide. And if this is of concern, please skip the first couple of minutes because the rest of it is eye-opening. So strap yourselves in. Here come the young pups, and they're going to give you something to think about. All righty, we're going to start recording. So, Ben, can you give us just a little of where you learnt the significance of having good mental well-being?
Well, I suppose it came from half squad. My older brother, I suppose everyone knew Big Joey as a hero, big fella, good sportsman. Everyone thought everything was all right with him. It wasn't, and this probably started back in 96, maybe a touch earlier, but the first sign I ever known there was anything wrong with Joe, I know him and Dad used to fight and things like that. Dad was fairly hard. That was how it was. But Joe walked in there one day. He come in, he had marks around his neck and he's hurt his leg and things like that. And he's coming in. He's, anyway, he's tried to hang himself. And the tree branch broke. And from a thing, he's going, geez, you think he's going all right, to your, you know, big brother and every, you know, bit of a, well, local sporting hero, my eyes, you know, and then he's trying to, like, do himself in at that time. I'm going, I don't know. Anyway, and then the next 16 years was a fairly big learning experience, how low people can get, I suppose. And it got real bad. Coming back from weekends from Griffith when I was doing my apprenticeship out there, and me and my other brother would go, our weekend was, oh, well, you get home Saturday, probably play footy Saturday or whatever it was. But on Sunday, go get Joe out of Gissing House and take him to a movie in Wagga and then put him back in Gissing House again. And you go in there, it's pretty confronting going into these, you know, pretty much a psychiatric ward, I suppose. To go in, it's full security, go and get your brother out, take him out, go into the cinema. It's funny, at the time we just did it, but it was just it's confronting, and but
very tough as a young fella. And I suppose at that stage, Dad had no awareness of mental health. He was probably of the generation where, what, if you're having troubles or an issue, it's about working harder and it will come good, do you think?
Well, what's bloody wrong with you? Get on with it. And I suppose at that time, Dad was probably, that's probably a fair view. Like, that's how everyone thought. And pretty much the only support was going to Gissing House, which is obviously the extreme end of any mental health. You know, doesn't make anyone feel very well having to go, yeah, geez, I'm going to Gissing House on the weekend.
And the reputation of those formal places early days was that for a lot of us, people who went into those places, we basically didn't see again. That was a real issue. Now, while they have changed how they do things and they're more open in interaction with community, people still are very wary of Gissing House. People I deal with that have serious stuff and know that they have to go to Gissing House will need to do anything to avoid it. So
there's a lot of stigma.
There's a lot of stigma with it. Mick, it's a harder one to follow, I suppose. So, and I mean, yeah, when did you start realising the significance of mental well-being on living on, whether it's farming or whatever?
I guess the last couple of years been more made more aware of mental health issues. I've always thought, you know, I don't have much. When you hear stories of Ben, or, you know, I've sat in at one of these seminars before and you think, I don't really have much to talk about. And I've always, you know, when we talk about tough times in life, there's tough times in business and then there's tough times in life. And I think they're different. As a farmer, we deal with tough times in business all the time. And probably the one thing that is easier to get through those tough times is the certainty of what you're going through and what the outcome is at the end. You know, you always know that there's certainly going to rain after a drought. And, you know, probably the more devastating things that I've felt in business are the frosts and things like that. It's very sudden. And, you know, you one day you've got a great crop and the next day you've got a frost and there's nothing. And picking yourself up from that is probably the hardest. But you know that at the end of the year, you burn that bloody stubble and you start again next year and things go on. Tough times in life, I've probably experienced a side of mental health that, it's probably the toughest I've had to deal with yet. And that was seeing a son go through mental health issues with more from anxiety. And the thing that probably struck me the most, he's coming out the other end of it now, is how fickle the human mind is and how easily it can be triggered into a downward spiral. And that's the uncertainty. There's no certainty there like we do in our business tough times. And when you're dealing with mental issues, there's not always a certainty of a correct diagnosis. And then there's no certainty really in what the treatments are and how you deal with those issues.
Well, there's no timeline, is there? That's the thing.
How
long you have to ride this out for? You think, oh, yeah, I get this. Oh, yeah, I might get right in 6 months. But it was like 16 years and then Joe died of a heart attack. That was the end of that.
So we had some professionals involved in psychologists and to know that you couldn't just go to the doctor and get a cast on a broken arm, which was you knew what to do for the next 6 weeks with it. There was no definitive, well, this is what he's suffering from and this is how we're going to fix it. And that's probably been the hardest part of the last 2-year journey we've had.
that one of the benefits of farming is that even though it can get really tough, there's generally a turning point, an end point that we know things are going to get better.
And we've grown up with it, John. You know, from a young kid, we know, we sit on the tractor and, you know, you'll see the dust and we know that animals die and all those things. So, we're acclimatized to it right from a young age. But, you know, with health issues and stuff like that, we're not acclimatized to it, exposed to it as readily, I guess.
And you relayed to me a story, I think, that really highlights why people struggle to talk about their mental health, and that is that we often, people talk about it in terms of weakness and stuff. And I'm talking about the young fella going from a local school to a boarding school in Canberra, which you would think at first mention that that is cruel and terribly tough on somebody that's struggling with anxiety. But can you tell us a little bit about the story and the reasoning why you made that hard decision?
I guess to give it some context, he had a couple of incidents, an injury, and then a couple of anaphylactic shocks that just triggered him into a deep sense of anxiety, for one, to the point where he couldn't really walk unassisted. And when we finally got him exercising and walking, got him back to school after missing probably 3 months, that was during COVID too, but he missed even more than most, he devised ways of getting around the school so that he could always be touching a wall, because he didn't want to walk without touching something. And if he had to walk across a road, he'd pretend to step down and do his shoelaces up so that he could touch the ground to give himself, it was just in his mind. But we knew that from what we'd been told, exercise was one of the things that would get him going, but trying to push him to be on a push bike or walking was a daily struggle. You know, when we got back to school, he'd kind of, he isolated himself. He was very self-conscious and he kind of isolated himself from his friends, I guess. And as 10-year-olds, you can't expect too much from his mates to really understand what he was going through. So, you know, they tried their best, but he just didn't want to be involved in their activities. So, you know, to see him sitting on his own at lunchtime was hard for the teachers. It was hard for my wife when she was in there at canteen and things. But so to come to the end of year six and think, what are we doing with him now? Are we going to send him through in that environment? He was classed as a sick child. You know, he thought of himself as sick. His kids thought of him as sick, as ill. He was always going to go to boarding school. His other two older siblings went in year seven, but we just didn't think he was ready. The teachers certainly didn't think he was ready. But we kind of reflected on something you told us years ago, John, in one of your stories about as farmers, we, you know, if we've got a sick sheep in the mob, it's out on its own, the best thing we can do is go and get it. You bring it in, you treat it, and you get it back with the mob as soon as you can, because that's where it's the happiest, in the flock. And we kind of knew that Finn, where he was, he wasn't happy in that flock. You know, it was going to be the same if he moved up to the high school. So the best thing we could do, but the hardest thing we could do, was to push him to go to boarding school. And people thought we were mad. And when we drove away from Canberra after that first day, we thought, what have we done? And for the first couple of weeks, I think, as everyone knows, they send a kid to boarding school, you get those, I don't want to be here, get me home. But we knew from past experience, we just had to ignore it. And I guess we're into fourth term now. And he's nearly there. To finish what I was saying, I think he's found his flock.
And he's basically turned it around from being in a community where they thought of him as a sick kid, perhaps a weak kid. He goes to a community that doesn't know him at all and they treat him, in italics, normal.
Just he needed a fresh start.
Yep, he just needed to break that cycle. As Heather said, he's on the recovery. And so I guess the whole story is how fickle the mind is and how uncertain that journey to recovery is, but how good it feels when you can see that there is recovery there.
But it is difficult in regards to mental health. There's periods or times where you've got to make tough decisions for a better outcome. But in doing so, Michael, you didn't do this solo or with your wife. You took on board the opinions of experts, professional people?
Yeah, I mean, we had psychologists involved early on in diagnosing and giving us some strategies, and we've used some, but a lot of it was, well, it's parenting. You make it up as you go, and you be gentle and kind where you can, but you give them a kick up the bum and say, get up and get going when when you need to. And I think that was probably what we had to do.
All right, thanks, Mick. Emma, last cab off the rank here. I don't think my awareness of your life cycle is nothing quite that drastic, but for me, I find it interesting that you come from a farming family who had the misfortune to lose their farm in the 80s drought. So then there was that business that a father had to go through. And this whole experience of getting put up the front here to talk has been, I believe, what, one of the catalysts to start making you reflect on the importance of mental health, on mental well-being of your friends and people around you?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I don't suffer mental health myself. I'm a bit anxious and whatnot, but if I start to feel a little bit overwhelmed, I just think just keeping busy is a good thing, like, and having a target, and, you know, whether it be just to cleansing your mind with a run or the gym or something where you're not thinking about what's worrying you for an hour of every day is helpful.
So seizing on that point alone, do you think that may be why we find in our past farming generations we never really talked about mental well-being, because we could actually go and put in and work hard?
Yes. And I think back then, you know, you guys used to play tennis, and it's different now. Like, we catch up with the community through our kids a lot at the moment. Like, they play sport, thankfully, and we have a social life because of them. But you guys used to, like, catch up and play cards. We don't really do that anymore. I don't know whether that it's because connecting with community and connecting with other people, whether you talk about that you're depressed or not, helps with not being depressed, helps not think about those things, and you're talking to people, and maybe it might come up. I'm not a very good one to actually ask people, are they okay? But maybe in the last sort of 3 years, like, we've got a really good bunch of friends around us, and they've just started asking. And sometimes you are a bit down. You're like, yeah, actually, I don't feel that great. And they've noticed. And then you have a chat about it, and then you feel a lot better. So we just amongst girls, I sometimes will ask now, but it's a confronting question to ask anyone.
So on a personal level, this is probably low level and preventative stuff that we're talking about, but you find it in general, you're hearing it from more women. Is that because you're a woman, or you just think in general that's what it is?
I think so, yeah, just in general.
And when you go out professionally as an agronomist advising farmers about cropping and that, what kind of things have you been seeing? Has it been there all the time, or is there different periods where?
I started agronomy in 2002 in Forbes, and I was told that the Caracatel floodway flooded every 10 years, and it was on the 11th year. It didn't flood again until, I don't know, maybe 2005 or 2010. So it was a long time after that. It didn't rain for 2 years while I was there. That was my two first years. And they were really down, those guys. Like, I got, I think I started in February, and they had 8 inches of rain or 6 inches of rain in 2 weeks, and then it didn't rain again basically for the whole year. A lot of canola got sown. Was it the year of swaps, canola swaps? Everyone took out swaps, didn't actually produce any canola, rolled it over to the next year, same thing again. It was really horrible, but we just drank a lot of coffee, talked a lot. No talk of depression, though. There was really no actual verbal talking about them being down.
So all of their flatness and down was focused on no crops, on the actual physical outcomes.
Also, just getting through it. Like, what are we going to do? Right, I'm going to have to buy some feed for the sheep. We're going to have to do this. And it was just a week-to-week thing. And as you said, Mick, you know, like, they come through it in the end. Something will happen, or it'll rain, and then there is a little bit of loosen to cut for hay on the seepage country. Or, you know, they were okay and they did get through it, but there were no farms sold at the time.
Anybody who knows you know that you're a bubbly, effervescent type of lady. How were you feeling working in an environment like that, at this stage you had no awareness of mental well-being, that, but how were you feeling when everything was doom and gloom around you?
I didn't think I wanted to be an agronomist. I thought I had to move, or otherwise I wasn't going to do it anymore because I wasn't a good counsellor. Well, I didn't think I was, but yeah.
Go on, hold on.
Em was just touched. I was a agronomist too, and I did it for 10 years and went out, and I never realised at the time, and I think Em's probably underselling it a bit, how important those professionals are going onto a farm. And they're not just agronomists, and they're not trained counsellors, but they do a lot of it. And a lot of it is listening. You know, they say guys will never talk face-to-face, but they'll talk sitting side-by-side when you're driving around in the ute. And I think there was... I never realised what it was going on at the time until I finished the agronomy, just how much of that does happen. And it is quite important because it can be the only contact a grower will get for the week is that visit from the agronomist. So,
have you ever thought about that aspect at all, Ben? We went out today and talked with the Crutches. They had a kind of a debrief and whatever with me informally.
We're thinking about farming, especially if you're at Forbes, maybe a touch more remote where we are. We're a social animal. And we don't, like out on the farm, you're away from everyone all the time. You don't get to, you know, because people think it's a joke when I say, look, I've only really, well, I see my wife and that at night, but I've had the dogs for the whole week and just yelled at sheep. And that's pretty much, you know, I'm only 20 k's out of tomorrow. And people think it's a joke. But just on talking things like that, you say canola swaps, things like that too. And I just reckon now, maybe back earlier, I'm not quite sure, say back in 95 and it, I reckon 95 was the turning point for agriculture between old farming and then the corporate thing just overtook. But I think maybe people might have been a bit more honest, maybe. Like, I know when I've made very bad financial decisions in the farm, I'll say, look, I shouldn't have sold that. I should have done this. I should have done that. And then I'm assuming there would have been people around me who could have said, yeah, geez, I've done that back in 02 and made me feel a bit better. Yeah, we've all done stupid things. And I just find sometimes that's... that's nice to hear, even though it's probably not going to make your bank balance any better, your wife any happier, but at least you just go, geez, I only feel like a fool for the next 3 months, and after that, I'll be worried about something else anyway and get on with it. So
any one of you, is that kind of support and appreciation of your predicament easier to come from mates or friends as opposed to, say, having to present to professionals?
Some of the people I have my biggest confessions to probably don't necessarily like me, would invite me to dinner, but we can have a chat here or there. It's just socialising with lots of different people. You seem to pick up a little bit from everyone maybe. Your best friends probably don't want to tell you that you're being give you the best advice. Maybe they're being too nice.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Here on this panel at either end, we've got two, I believe, different types. Ben, you're a blunt type. So to a certain extent, even if you don't like it, I'm presuming to a certain extent, because I know you, that you prefer it blunt and straight to the point. Whereas Emma, I get the feeling that you're not as confident. So then, say with some of your friends, you talk around the subject, hoping that eventually it gets addressed, but nobody actually precisely addresses it. Would that be so?
Yep, definitely. Skirt around the edges, hope something gets dropped and doesn't. But that's fine too. You're just talking, and talking's good, I think.
And so do those signs when you get worried about your friends, is that from what they're saying or is it a gut feeling?
It's what they're not saying, but that's not necessarily right either.
Yeah, Mick?
A lot of times it's probably the things that aren't overt that are probably in reflection mean the most. So during, you know, our time with Finn, usually, you know, if you're in a bad time, one of us, you know, if Edwina, my wife, is down, well, I'm usually there to lift her up or vice versa, and the kids, you know, they're there to help me. But with Finn, we were both down and we were dealing with our own problems. We were probably dismissive of each other's feelings as well to a point, and we were trying to help each other out and tell other friends what was going on. And one of my best mates, I never really thought about the time until earlier in the year, he was ringing me once a week, and we don't, you know, we talk and everything, but it's never a direct conversation about how you're going. But he was ringing saying, how's Finn, and, you know, how are things going? And he's also my agronomist, so he would come out and we'd drive around. And I was only thinking there a few months ago, he was, an agronomist very rarely comes onto your place and drives around and leaves without recommending that you spray something or spend some money. but he did that on a number of occasions. You know, come on, we've got to go and look at the crops. Let's go for a drive. And he left without any recommendations. And I thought it was odd, but I realised what he was doing.
So that bloke was probably a little switched on, but it's a similar pattern to what Emma was saying with her friends, isn't it? We don't necessarily talk directly about the topic. And I suppose one of the challenges is, do we need to speak directly about it, or can we keep people up by doing what we're doing? And I suppose the challenging thing for me is I'd like to think that we could keep it low level, but the stats are increasing. So does that mean we need to be more active? What's your take, Ben?
I think it's very hard to know what's going on at home. Just for our instance, it surprised me. Don't worry, some people noticed, some people didn't, but just with a big fella that things were really bad and everything that we're doing him with, like mum was too ashamed to talk about it. Dad didn't want to know about it, and that's fine. Things were really, really bad. There's no way anyone could have known. There was no way to explain it. You just never know what's going on in someone's head for a start, and people can't describe it themselves, let alone ask for help.
And we're going to pause for a break there, mainly because I want the audience to think about some of these points that we've made up to now. Is that okay? It seems like we all have heard the stories of you need to ask, are you okay? And that we need to be able to say it's okay not to be okay. But as our speakers have highlighted the point, that's easier said than done. And the thing is that while it's very good that we can keep our mates and friends up, okay, at this stage, the statistics are telling us that mental health and well-being are getting worse. So if we maintain what we're doing at this present time, we're going to get the same results, which means well-being in our communities, in our families, is going to be an increasing problem. So I would like you to talk about that in there and come back, and that's what our focus will be for the second period with the speakers, is what kind of strategies have they used up to this point? Do they think we need to go harder with some of these or not? Thank you.
We're going to get back to this in a sec. This first section, bloody interesting, isn't it? Just a quick word to thank our sponsors.
This podcast is a Room 3 production and is brought to you by our mates at the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries and their Farm Business Resilience Program team. The Farm Business Resilience Program supports farmers to improve their business acumen and achieve their business goals. The Farm Business Resilience team offers business coaching, farm tours, networking events, and the creation of resources for farmers across New South Wales. We'd also like to thank and acknowledge those of you who have donated to Mate Helping Mates GoFundMe campaign. Your commitment has been integral to our work.
Welcome back, mates. Just like all our other episodes, this section we're going to hand the mics around, give you a heads up. We actually have two Emmas. So one of the Emmas that are highlighted in this section is a young farmer's wife who also happens to be an outreach counsellor. So let's get into it. When we left off, we were having a bit of a break and to talk about that it seemed that the main message in that first session was that we've had people with lived experience who are prepared to talk about mental health and well-being. And it seems to me that that's an indication that the younger generation are reasonable good at that to a certain level. But our challenge is actioning that. And some of our conversation has been along the lines of a bit more awareness amongst our speakers of some of the little things that we do or involved in that we hadn't realized actually helps well-being. Like that, I think you related a bit where you were talking about the agronomist that was randomly ringing you or dropping out but wasn't hitting you for money for advice and stuff.
Yeah, mate, he was ringing as a mate rather than as a professional. So, you know, appreciate that, but he was probably using his professional angle to connect with me rather than directly as a mate. And that's I guess, you know, as we said before, as blokes, we don't sit face to face and talk about things. We're always sitting side by side, or it's gestures or little things that we don't want to seem too obvious about it, but we want to try and make a difference somehow.
And it may have been like an option that you wouldn't avoid too. Like if you had said, let's go and have a coffee, or let's go to the pub and have a beer, you might be like, I don't actually really feel like that.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's out of the ordinary too. It's not something that you do.
Yeah, yep, that's right. And he wanted to see you and he thought that you needed to see him, and that was the best way that he could do it.
So in some regards, really, it gets to a stage where it's out of our pay grade, basically. And I suppose the challenge then is, where's the line drawn between us as ordinary people doing the best we can and where service providers, whatever, may step in or be there? I've got somebody in the audience. Tony wants to speak. I don't know if it's about this specific part, but yes, Tony?
Privileged to know all three of our speakers and damn fine people. Which you talked about just briefly about talking to people, Ben, and knowing what to say and say the wrong thing or right thing. I wonder whether sometimes, well, it's not the wrong thing because it's the communication line's open. You know, sometimes, yes, everyone knows me, I put my foot in more times than not, but whether it's right or wrong, your thoughts?
Shows all three? Shows you care, doesn't it?
I suppose at that given point, Tone, it might make any difference, but you need sleep on it. Three sleeps later, you go, hang on.
Exactly.
He's a dirtbag, that bloke, but I go, look, I will go chat to him because he's put himself out there, I suppose.
Even if you target him at football next weekend.
That's right.
It's at least you've got some frustration out there. You've taken my head off.
That's right, yeah.
And Mick, similar thing put to you from Tony. We all understand, isn't it? Sometimes it's easier, some of this messaging for help coming from mates, because we understand our mate. We know Tony's a buffhead. So that if he doesn't quite get it out or spit it out properly, we know his intentions are good. Do you believe that with most of your mates, that they have your best interests or intentions?
Yeah. Well? And as I keep saying, it doesn't have to be overt. It doesn't have to be the direct words of I've got your back, but it's just making that connection with a phone call or whatever. It's ringing up and say, come and play tennis or something like that. You know that they're there for you, so...
And I think Emma's story about the level she helps people highlights that is understanding your own personality, reflecting on your own abilities, as well as the person you're trying to help becomes important. And as I often point out, who best knows your family member or your mate who's struggling than family or mate? I didn't know Joe when he was young. And I'm hearing that he was treated like a bit of an outcast. When I knew Joe and he was a worker and older, he was bloody well accepted into the workforce. You couldn't have got a better worker, workmate, kept the vibe of the shed up than Joe.
Was there a stage, can you remember when there's a crossover between when he, because he used to just go eat lunch, go sit out in the car and eat, or go sit out on the step and eat, not talk at lunchtime? I can't remember when that was a bit of a crossover, but that's when things were getting really, really bad. He'd work. He'd always, you know, smile and chat. But then as soon as, work was just, you know, have smoke or whatever, he'd just retract from everyone else. And that was just one of the, because people used to go, what's wrong with Joe? I said, it's just Joe. Like, I don't know.
So that mirrors a lot. So one of the other people we were thinking about having talk was a young fella called Phil Maroney. He's a shearer and he's the same. He will tell a similar story that when he's flat and struggling, he will go and sit out in his ute and eat his lunch. When he's good, and one of the strategies that makes him stay good and feel good is that when he picks up somebody else in the team is struggling, he ends up making it his mission to help that person. And once again, this comes back to understanding the personality of the people. Joe was way more reticent and quieter, so he was harder to get a read on. But as I said, who knows better than his mates and friends? And Ben saying how difficult that is, even when he's your own brother. And you know, and this is our challenge, you know, has anybody else in the audience got similar sorts of things of how do they connect or how did they connect with people that they were pretty sure needed help? But here we go. This is our issue, isn't it? It is actioning what we know. People are talking, as I said, about are you okay? And it's okay not to be okay. Have you got anything to say on this, Emma? What are the people like that present to you? Are they at their wits' end and go to you, or are they encouraged by their mates? So is it possibly the individuals with the problem go to see you, or are they encouraged, or they come with a mate?
It varies. Sometimes it's people seeking help for themselves or a family member. Sometimes someone has been given my details from someone else and they pass that on once they establish that someone they care about is struggling, and they encourage that person who is struggling to reach out to me. But it's not just about asking if they're okay, which is great to ask someone if they're okay and then sit in that space with them when maybe they explain that they're not. But it's also looking out for other signs that they're not okay. So changes in their behaviour, people who are sleeping more or less, eating more or less, doing things that they didn't used to do, risk-taking behaviour, or not being spontaneous anymore. And though looking out for those sorts of behavioural clues that someone might be not okay, and then asking that question.
So in winding up and concluding, I think we've still got the same challenge, is that we understand that to deal with mental health and well-being, we need to be comfortable and able to speak about it. The challenge is actually actioning that. It's interesting that in some of my stuff, when I look at research, there's a survey being put out in regards to connection in rural society. And what they came back with was something like 87% of people in the bush believe they are better connected than they've ever been. But the interesting fact for me comes back that 74% of the people surveyed said they are lonelier than they've ever been. So while they're connected on the phones, the mobile phones, all of that kind of stuff, they're connected, they're missing out on the proper engaging of people.
So a good example of that is back 20 years ago, you go down the street to do your banking, but now you just sit there at the kitchen table and you do it all on your phone and you think, this is awesome, I can get it all done. But you're not talking to anyone as you're doing it.
So I suppose that's the crux of the challenge as we go to the future generation, is society and our community is changing. It's not going to go backwards. They're not going to go and put face-to-face banking back into tomorrow. It ain't going to happen. Okay. Instead of just ranting and raving about it, we've got to be proactive in looking at how are we going to address these changes to our society.
But is that part of modern world though? Like how many wives are now having to work? How many, like, who's at home when the kids come home? You know, we were poor back then, but now we're time poor. And it seems to be a struggle to get to everything and to do everything. Whereas back in those days, I think you touched that everyone went to play tennis. It was cheap, it was social, mum, dad, kids went. Now it's we struggle to get everywhere. We struggle to get to all the school functions. We struggle. Is that modern world? Is that society? Do we have the bar too high?
Yeah, Ken?
Well, what I'm going to say, I should have brought up long before you started the actual finishing touches, which I'm cutting in on. I going back to, we lost a boy, and the police called him about midnight one night and told us we'd lost a boy. Well, before that, if anyone lost a wife or a husband or something, I found it very hard to talk to them. You didn't bring the subject up. You sort of talked all around it, not trying to think, oh, you know, I don't want them thinking about it now. But after that happened, if I was talking to somebody, I would actually bring the subject up, because it just helped me so much to talk about it rather than try and avoid it. And I'm just wondering if that's not some sort of connection in what you're trying to do. Anyway, that's just the way I look at it.
Well, I think that is exactly what we're trying to do. We're talking about it. But as I said, our biggest challenge now is that I believe, in my opinion, the younger generation are more comfortable talking about it, but we're still getting these bad statistics. So then how are we going to action it? And what people have said, that society has changed, that things have changed, that's fact. And as I said, we can point that out and we can say that, but it doesn't still change the end result of more suicides, more
more poor mental well-being, we've got to actually action something. I think our speakers gave us some ideas on what they think, okay, engaging meaningfully with people, you know, and valuing people, answering phone calls and stuff.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, I feel like we can never talk about mental health enough. The more we can have those conversations with each other, the more we remove that stigma that unfortunately is still attached to it. You know, the more we can see big, strong, rural blokes stand up and talk about their journey with mental health, the easier it makes it for the next person to go, oh, well, actually, I've been struggling and now I see you open up about it. I feel like I can open up about it. I've always been very open about my mental health journey, and that's what prompted me to get into that space and turn that into my career. I've been on antidepressants since I was 15. Realistically, they have saved my life multiple times. And the more that we can get more people, particularly rurally, to stand up and tell those stories, the more it makes it easier for the next person to do the same thing. And the more we can talk about mental health and normalize that conversation, like we're talking about what we're going to have for dinner, then the more hopefully we can reduce that suicide rate.
Beauty. Thanks, Emma. Thank you very much. We'll keep prattling out there and keep going. Beauty. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Miss Emma.
Thanks,
Mrs.
John.
Emma. Yep. Well, mates, there it is. Some wisdom from our young pups. We're all part of the same herd. If there's an opportunity, turn to somebody else and give them a hug and show them that you care and that we always can relate to one another. Special thanks to our speakers, and of course, an extra special thanks to all you buggers that are sitting there and participating in this discussion. And listeners, I'm hoping this energy and courage is flowing through the airways so that you can get off your ass, help yourself, and help others. Mate helping mate. Please tune in to our other episodes, such as Old Farts. Our next episode in the series is a recording with another young pup, Joe Briggs from Collie Ambley, and Pete the Ambo, who works in the Riverina area as a first responder, but she also has lived experience. On behalf of the Mate Helping Mate team, I would like to offer the invitation that if you would ever like to reach out, please feel free to send us a message via the Mate Helping Mate Facebook page or Instagram page. Thanks, mate, and I hope your ears are still attached. Great.
This podcast was a Room 3 production and is brought to you by our mates at the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries and their Farm Business Resilience Program team. Episodes of this podcast can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts by searching for Mate Helping Mate and hitting subscribe. If you've liked what you've heard, make sure you leave a rating to make it easier for others to find us. Better yet, share it with your friends and family to start a conversation about mental health in the bush. This podcast was produced by Aaron Johnson and Lara Shearer and recorded and directed, edited by AJ Clifford for Room 3, a production company that works with not-for-profits and social enterprise. Original music by Southwark Sounds and stock by Soundstripe. Also, a massive thanks to John Harper, who for over the years has travelled this country tirelessly working to improve mental health in rural and remote Australia. And of course, his awesome offsider Michelle for her continued support for John and his work. We'd also like to thank and acknowledge those of you who have donated to Mate Helping Mate's GoFundMe campaign. Your commitment to seeing John do his thing has been integral to our work. In finishing, a reminder that this podcast featured general information only, and we recommend that you get independent advice from a qualified professional. Mate Helping Mate has links on the website with a number of great service providers across the country. Head to matehelpingmate.org.au. If you're struggling with your mental health now and need to talk, call Lifeline anytime on 13 11 14. Thank you for listening, and we hope this has helped you.